Okay, well, next week is the last week of the season, you know that, so don't forget to come next week. And the next one after that will be September 11th, I think that's the right date, so, and it will be a nice break. I looked ahead a little bit in my sketch study book, and it will work out really fine, because we'll start out with Fuller Seminary, the school itself, and move forward to it. So all of what we've had now is background of the neo-evangelicals, and Fuller Seminary is just only one aspect of what will come out of that. So it's I'll enjoy my time off for the summer. I hope you do too, and have not to come back on Wednesday night. Although it's not a chore, is it? It's only a chore for me during the week. Well, last week I left you. I'll tell you this later. But last week I left you with 2 weeks not knowing what to do. Right? Remember that? I said we're about at a point where don't want to go into the Fuller Seminary thing. And so I always edit my lessons the next day in the morning, and I listened to my lesson, and I came to 2 points in the lesson where I said, we need some more time to look into this. I said, well, there's my lessons. Dummy, well, listen to yourself. So that's what we're going to do. Actually, it's really one subject, but we're going to do it in two bites. And I was kind of watching people walk by, and they look in here, and I'd say, I had my apologetic screen up here, and I had the word on the board, and I said, never mind, just keep on going. So I hope that wasn't your temptation, because apologetics, the idea may be a little scary for you, and it ought not to be. But that is kind of the background or the subject of our study tonight in the context of what we're discussing in church history. Not an easy subject because it has so many facets to it, so I'll probably butcher it. But if I butcher it, it'll be my butcher, so leave it go at that. So we have next week, which would be the last week. So we did finish the background work on founding a Fuller Seminary. Remember, it gets founded in September of 1947. Fuller Seminary has received a great amount of attention because it was to be unique in its formation, one of a kind. And it was sort of abrasive to the other denominational schools because here comes Fuller and saying, we're going to be beat you all, in a sense. And the Presbyterians don't like it, and neither did the others. So we'll talk about that. But it was unique in its formation. You know, one man has an idea. That's probably not unique, but one man had an idea and the wherewithal to carry it out. Anyway, this seminary was supposed to be the standard for seminaries. That's probably what irked everybody else, could be the standard. Wish it would have been. And I remember this seminary started because Bible institutes were started by like-minded people, sometimes might call them denominations or a group of churches that had been formed in this early 20th century period. And they were founded to train laymen and laywomen, lay people, for the churches. They weren't meant to be preparing scholars, even for pulpits. That only came because the liberal seminaries, mainline denominational seminaries turned liberal, and so they looked to the institutes to do the training. So we had a lot of people came out of the institutes that had a three-year training program, and some of these young guys out of high school with 3 more years went into the pulpits, you know, small rural areas sometimes. So that was unusual, not unusual for them to take the ministry, but that wasn't their intention with these schools. So in a sense, there becomes a pent-up need for further, or let's call it advanced education at the seminary level. So the idea of Fuller Seminary, Fuller the namesake, came from one person who pitched the idea to his close contacts, Harold Ockenguy and Wilbur Smith. Ockenguy on the East Coast, Wilbur Smith in Chicago at Moody. Now, Fuller wanted to establish a theoretical or theological school that was more serious than the ordinary Bible institutes. And in his words, he wanted an MIT, comes out of Boston, of the West. Harold Ockenguy, the first president of the National Association of Evangelicals, was recruited by Fuller to be the kind of fundamentalist who could provide the necessary leadership, and I might even add scholarship. Fuller was a fundamentalist. He was a dispensationalist with a sincere, I believe, sincere vision for the evangelization of the lost, and it was shared equally probably by Ockenguy, who had sponsored some of his radio rallies in Boston. evangelistic meetings, we sometimes call them revival meetings. To accomplish this, Fuller had urged to establish a higher level of education institution. And it may be a couple of reasons here. One, because of the loss of Princeton to the liberals, or liberals and moderns are going to be interchangeable. I'm going to try to use the word modernist because it probably isn't so loaded as the liberal is, but really the same ideas. Because Fuller, and let's do this again, it urged to establish a higher level of education. Perhaps it came to Fuller because of the loss of Princeton Seminary to the modernists in the 1920s. And Achengay had started there, I'll tell you this in a minute, but he had started there, didn't graduate there, and went to Westminster because Princeton had already drifted so far from the course. A school Achengay attended, which I just said, from which he did not graduate. Did I do that? I'm going to do that again. He did join the newly formed Westminster Seminary. By the way, Westminster Seminary was not a dispensational school. Okay, I mean, it was probably an anti-dispensational school, as it turned out. Although Presbyterian originally, Fuller, now a Baptist, may have had Princeton, a prestigious school, in his mind when he wanted to establish one on the West Coast. Maybe this is a bigger issue than anything. Fuller's son Daniel attended Princeton, and there's correspondence between he and his mother. They had a relationship. And where he complains about the school, and she tells him to hang in there. You know, maybe you can make an influence there. And some of this we'll get into next fall. But Princeton was drifting off course, and so it could well be that Father Fuller decided that it would be nice for his son to have a school to go to that would be approved and wouldn't be like Princeton where you get off track. So Fuller's son Daniel attended Princeton, realizing the evangelical spirit, quote, was gone, needing another school for a son or sons like him. When they, that is Fuller and Achengay and others, added to evangelicalism was the zeal for scholarship, which they had regarded as crucial if Christianity was to have a lasting impact on Western civilization. We're going to define this in a little bit here, so don't wonder too much what we're talking about. I'm going to explain this, so we'll just leave it at that. They saw this tradition as extending back through Calvin, this scholarship, through Calvin, through Augustine, and even to the Apostle Paul. So we would agree with that. The Bible is not written at a low level of scholarship. In fact, it's high-level stuff. While scholarship, defined, had barely survived in popular fundamentalism, although there was a lot of scholarship written from the Reformed point of view, and some from the dispensational point of view, which was a newer, you know, ism. There was a lot of that, and remained vigorous at Princeton Seminary with J. Meshon Gratian, also writing, and from the intellectual point of view for the fundamentalists, but not lots. So as we have said, the next move for Fuller was to make contacts with, which he did with Achengay and with Smith. And that's where we left the study last week, and we'll pick it up there in the fall of 2019. So I was mentioning our lessons are like building a car on an assembling line. Parts are made separately and then brought to the assembly and put into final production. So in our study of history, it necessitates a study of these parts once in a while to make up the whole. So with these two sessions left this spring, it occurred to me that twice in our last session, I had mentioned that we need to stop and make another part before going on, but time restraint forbid it. But now we have 2 weeks left, so it's almost fortuitous that it worked out that way. And it says one part, but actually it's two part, but it's really somewhat the same subject. Behind all of this now is winning America. And the apologetic question about that is, how are we going to do it? How are we going to win America? Now, you have no idea what that means, do you? Win America? If I'd ask you what it means, I'd probably have hands up. We don't really know what it means, frankly. I don't know what it means. So here's what we're going to do. Since we can agree on what we don't agree on, let's agree that we don't agree. All right? So for our discussion, the neo-evangelical objectives of Fuller, Henry and Achengay, bear in mind that we are going to use winning America without a working definition or an objective meaning. They were interested in winning America. True, they said that. But this is a broad statement by whom is speaking here. Was it a covenantalist or is it a dispensationalist? We have different people saying different things at different times. If you're a covenantalist, you probably need one thing. If you're a dispensationalist, you might need another thing. So winning America had to do with, we go this far, preserving Western culture, Christian culture, we would say. The post-World War II West, the Christian West, the Manifest Destiny America West, the New Israel America West. All of these ideas are wrapped up in winning America. All mixed up with these, with a large overlayer or overreach of these issues in Christianity. So all I want you to have is kind of a feeling for it, because I think that's all they had for it. If they had something really specific for it, you could really go after it, but I don't think they had a real understanding of what it was even they were trying to do. Because you had some that thought we were New Israel, or at least leaning that way with a manifest destiny, that God was blessing America in a special way, and they're almost a special people like Israel was a special people, that God's going to take care of America in a certain way, then you have a certain approach to your Christianity. If you're a dispensationalist, now I have to say that we are probably clearer on our dispensationalism and the distinctions of it than they were back then. That was before even Rari wrote his book. I'm always thinking everybody was understood the way we do forever, but that's not true. There's a lot of sloppiness going on. So they weren't very clear either, because Fuller was a dispensationalist, so I'm not sure exactly what he'd say either, because he was a strong patriot, and he would have been strong for American, you know, servicemen as he went off to the Western theater when the men came to his Long Beach, California services. Many of them were saved there. You know, just what was all in his mind? We don't know. But we do know that winning America is a good enough catchphrase, whatever they're going to do, but that's what we got to do. So keep that in mind in our thinking. So winning America had to do with preserving Western culture. I did that already, with a large mix of Christianity overlaid. So the whole concept of the winning America will remain elusive. Since most could not give an objective definition of it, we also will not. That'll help us a little bit. Because if you stop and want to explain it the way we would understand it, we're never going to get anywhere. Because you'll see so many roadblocks. Why did they do this? Why did they do that? Why did they do this? Well, they're not thinking like we're thinking. They're thinking like they're thinking. And to that extent, some way, it makes some sense. So missing from last week's lesson is a discussion on apologetics and ethics. So we're going to do apologetics or both of these weeks, but it really is going to be on ethics next week, because apologetics and ethics connect, and I'll show you. I hope you'll see that. Apologetics is just a funny word, I guess. We don't use it this way in our street language, but it just basically is social contact between people. You know, it's me convincing somebody else, you know, to buy a car or whatever, and usually in Christian apologetics, it's had to do with witnessing or standing for the truth or explaining the truth, you know, so we have this. Are these two guys looking at each other and they're talking to each other and they're probably engaging in some form of apologetics if they're talking about, you know, something that's Christian. One guy's saved, one's not. Obviously, then it's going to be going on. So with this word we have, concept of defending Christianity, promoting Christianity, explaining Christianity, bearing witness of Christianity, giving evidence to Christianity, all these kind of things. Maybe there's a lot of other words we could pile in here too, because it's just a defense of something. Christianity, a defense of Christianity. So we need a discussion at this point about the form of apologetics to be adopted. Well, this is kind of sticky, because how are we going to talk about it? So what that is, what kind of arrangements or arguments are persuasive, making the mind open, and I put that in quotes, to the truth? What are the kinds of apologetics moderated by the various opportunities presented? So it seems like if you have one or one guy's talking, and he's my neighbor, and I've seen him, lived next door to him for 5 years, and he's going to live there for another 5 years or 20 years, and I've talked to him a lot of times, I'm going to apply something to him, a way of explaining my Christianity. They'll be totally different than I'm talking to a guy at the gas station or sitting next to a guy in an airplane seat. So we have these questions go into the our how we use our apologetics, how we talk about our faith. Then we have the other opportunities where you actually sit down in a formal session. And you say, now we go from point A to point B to point C to point D, and then you have a conclusion, like in a classroom. There you have a totally different approach to apologetics, perhaps, because you maybe you can deal with it more in a technical, classical, or structured sense. So all of these fall in the area of apologetics. So our question, what are the underlying apologetics of our subjects who intend to win America? What will they advocate for? Will they advocate for impeccable logic? Will they advocate for overwhelming evidence? Will they advocate for superior scholarship? Remember, these are means towards an end. You do these things, then it's going to be accomplished. Then you are making a great presentation of the truth. Fideism, which probably don't know that word very well, it's just a matter of the faith issue. Or will they depend on finely tuned points of theology of the redemptive work of Christ in history, which is kind of a convoluted, complicated statement, which is intended to be that way because that's what it would be. It's complicated and convoluted and hard to understand. And maybe even stretching it a little bit. So we want to know, what are these guys doing, you know, because we're watching what they're doing. So the second question we're not going to deal with tonight, but I just want to introduce it to you. The second question for next week is, and it relates to the first, still in the arena of apologetics, but shown in the pressing ethical concerns, because how you deal with the question of ethics becomes an apologetic. It becomes an argument, or a lack of one, however you want to put it. Last week said the topic must be dealt with in another series, who has time for it, which I said. But we did mention Carl Henry's criticism of the fundamentalists in action on social issues, which he raises in his book, The Uneasy Conscience. So his book, in a sense, is an apologetic. Okay? I'm not going to agree with it, but it's going to be one. It's going to be an argument that somebody needs to do something, because if we do it this way, then things will be better. Remember, we want outcomes to be positive. And he says we need to change our approach to things so the outcome will be different than the road we're on. So he writes his book. Well, since Henry, there is an urge spread by the book, easy conscience, uneasy conscience spreads to address social needs. And some of you maybe feel the pressure from 50 or 60 years ago, 70 years ago. Since now is motivation to press the Christian faith towards ethics, towards apologetics that would include ethics. To get people on board the argument about Christianity, we need to talk about ethics, so we are into apologetics. This, then, I believe, falls within the territory of apologetics, which is why I say both are the same, in the same category, same family. Well, I see all of these dissatisfactions voiced by the neo-evangelicals relating to the realm of apologetics. And the question is, how can we be convincing? Remember, we're going to win America. So in order to do that, I got to go out and convince some people, right? I mean, I got to convince them to whatever, because if I don't convince them, America's not going to change. So all of this has to do with convincing the subject. Again, this has to do with how ideas are of truth are related to others. Therefore, this is a social question, people to people. How does one person speak to convince the other? Especially as it relates to convincing the other about the truth and the gospel, or even about just the nature of God, any truth for that matter. Now, we could do an academic exercise with textbook in hand. I have one here, big black book, lots of pages, charts, well organized. We could do an academics exercise on the nature of the kinds of the apologetics to adopt. We're not going to do that, but we can't avoid the subject either. So be happy we're not going to do a book. Although it would be worthwhile doing. I'm not sure you'd stick with me. Because it gets into the theoretical. You know, where's Scott? He was out at Asheville today. I don't have time for this. But he was at Asheville today. You know what that is? At Royal Nebraska? Where the fossils lay unencumbered. Only place in the whole world where that exists like that. So it's worth the trip if you've never been there. And he's the opening day for, what's it called, Asheville? That's what it's called, yeah. First opening day for the season was today. And we were there, what time? 9 o'clock? 9 o'clock. First person there And he starts talking to the guy that's there, ends up being the curator of the place. And he started witnessing to him about what he sees there and, you know, what the Bible gets into it. So I'm thinking, he was using apologetics all the time, talking to this guy about why, you know, the stuff that he's thinking isn't right. He was very careful how he did that. But he's engaging in apologetics. I believe the Bible says that their worth is only 6,000 years old, and you ask questions and so forth. So we do this without even thinking, all right? That wasn't necessarily trying to convince him, but on the other hand, he was probably allowing to lay some seeds where he will not sleep tonight, probably, when he goes to bed. We hope, pray. All right, so the idea of the biblical word here, it's a biblical word. Remember, we always say, don't talk about biblical subjects without using biblical language, and that we need to do that. So we have two verses where I think we can tie into the scriptures. 1 Peter 3:15 says, Peter says, but sanctify Christ in your heart, set him apart in your heart, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who accounts or asks you to give an account. Well, the defense is the word, the apology, apologetic. And the defense is for the hope that's within you with gentleness and reverence. And we have that in Ephesians 4:15 talks about when we do this, we do it with speaking in truth, in love, and we are to grow up in all respects into him who is the head, even Christ. So this is basically what we understand when we call witnessing. And witnessing can be very formal, it can be very informal, it can be a casual comment, it can be actually a life lived consistently before your neighbors, which has to go with the words you use. All right, so that's where our idea comes from. Make a defense for everyone that asks. Now, I always wonder about that. You know, it says, do we have to wait till they ask? It says, what I'd say it probably means, whenever they ask, make sure you're ready. Because sometimes when they ask, you're not ready. So I don't think it means just when they ask, but for sure when they ask. So the apologetic is not a word in our street vocabulary, unless we mean apologize. That's how we think of it usually. But the field of apologetics is not one where we learn to apologize for past misdeeds or sin, which has its place. That's not what we're talking about. Apologetics is closely related to persuasion by reasoning or persuasion by whatever. I suppose if you got a guy in an armor neck hold and you say, you trust Christ or he's going to beat you up, that is a form of an apology. Not, you maybe owe him one, but it is a way to try get the point across. I'm not recommending that. But what we're trying to do is show how you would persuade somebody. And well, some of them use this, some of them use that. So in Christian apologetics, we're talking about how truth is communicated and asserted, and I would say asserted, weakly or strongly. Okay? So everyone adopts a style or approach of sharing any truth, including the gospel itself. We all use apologetics. All of us do. Now, if you want to know if that's kind of an unusual subject, no, there are just a bunch of books on apologetics. And we have, and every one of these probably has a kind of apologetics that it promotes, like Strobel, Evidence that Demands a Verdict, Defending the Gospel Through the Centuries. I don't know who that is. I think that's Clark. Van Til, Clark down the bottom, Machen, and another here, McManus. Most of the apologetists are what we call evidentialists, and most of these guys are. So Lee Strobel is, Josh McDowell is, Van Til is not, Clark was not, Machen was not. I don't know who this McMillis. He was from Biola. I don't know what he would have been. So anyway, I'm just showing you there are a lot of books, and some of these we carry, some we don't, and some say, I'm not a stickler on this stuff. Some are go to the mat for the kind of apologetics you use. And if you don't use any but the right one, you're wrong. I have never felt that way. I think that you use them all. It just depends on what's appropriate. And we talk about that a little bit too. But I still have my favorite and probably one that I use at a certain point when nothing else works. So our approach to apologetics, it would be helpful if we all understood how we answer this question in our own life as it relates to our expectations. That's where it goes. What do you expect when you witness? You guys, I expect them to say no every time. I mean, you expect every time you have witnessed, they will say no. Well, it doesn't matter what you do, right? But if you expect sometimes he's going to say yes, then you might be careful how you say it because you may begin to say yes twice. You know, so we got to not be totally dumb about this or ignorant about it or uninvolved. So it could be the silent approach as an apologetic. And we all have a silent witness when you drive your car. That's why I don't have bumper stickers on my car, because I might witness one thing in my driving and say something else on the bumper sticker, and it wouldn't be good. So, I mean, these are really concerns. Say, well, I'm going to let my life speak. That's why I'm not sure it's quite that good yet. But still, on the other hand, people watch what we do. I think our neighbors know when we go to church and we don't go to church. At least I think they do. And our garage goes up. You can set your clock on Sundays and on Wednesdays. You know, they know, where are you guys going, you know? So without telling them, they know this. So that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. So they will see Christ in me, we would say. Well, maybe. We hope so. But I hope maybe that might not be the end of it. Or other apologetics are a verbal one. There's a verbal one that confronts everyone. You know, you didn't find anybody that you didn't talk to. And there are some people that are that way. It drive me nuts because I just can't do it. I mean, everyone that comes along down the street, you're talking to them. I don't know. But I said, whatever works for them is fine. I'm never going to criticize what they do. So it could be both or many others or a combination of all. So we all assume an approach, and likely it varies with the occasion. And I might add this, don't put guilt on how you do it. You say, well, I don't think I did this right. I feel really bad about that. No, aren't you a Calvinist? Whatever you did, as best of your ability, is what God will use. And you might be surprised that what you think was really good was really not, was useless. Another thing you think, I didn't even know I said that, and that God uses it. If you're a teacher, you know how that works. I don't remember saying that. And they say, well, that's what you said. Well, I don't remember that. So anyway, God uses these things. So in classical apologetics, we discuss chiefly the beginning points, mostly. If we're going to sit in a classroom and go through the points, different kind of apologetics, we probably talk about somebody that is going to start from ground zero. He knows diddly squat about nothing. Now, what do you say to him? The first thing you say to him, that's going to be different than you talk to somebody that is grown up in the church and knows all the language, okay? And he's just rebellious. So in classical apologetics, we discuss chiefly the beginning points. Key to understanding these approaches is the truth about how we see the innate condition of man, which I think is just as important as the approach to apologetics. What do I expect out of this? If man is fallen or only partly fallen, makes a difference how you see your expectations. So our understanding concerning the nature and extent of the fall will affect our method of approaching another with the truth and our expectations. And there's no safe direction here. So if an Arminian view can quickly lead to manipulation, if it totally depends on the person you're talking to, and it depends on him, I can manipulate him. And that's what we got into with Charles Finney. They got good at manipulating people. They knew how to get them down to the altar. And they got them down there, and they knew how to make them cry, and then now how to make them weep, and how to get them to feel sorry for their sins, and, you know, without there being any repentance. That's not any good. Doesn't do any good. So an Arminian view can quickly lead to manipulation, to get an agreement to the gospel and not gain forgiveness. Example of these are the fruits of Charles Finney in evangelism. On the other hand, the Calvinist danger is that he knows that God is the final arbiter and will pass opportunities that an Arminian would not. To remain faithful and exercise a faithful defense or offense of the truth is a challenge for all of us. Whatever our success or failure, we are in the field of apologetics, a defense of the faith. Our friends in the forming of the Fuller Seminary operate from the same basis or the same kind of thing. And I'm not sure they thought about it. Although, when I read these histories, the word apologetics comes up quite often. So somebody's thinking about that, wondering what they're functioning from. Propensities. Well, those that have a Presbyterian affiliation or background will tend to be Calvinistic, tend to be, meaning that they understand the sovereignty of God in the nature of placing salvation. God elects. In some way, that's it. What else is there to say? Those who have a Baptist or are influenced by D.L. Moody, for example, will tend to give man a greater say in his salvation and thus tips to the Arminian side. Again, we're not talking about falls down completely. You know, sometimes it's a matter of degrees. So I've not read any assessment regarding the assumed apologetics of our main players in the forming of the neo-evangelicals. So what we're left with is to watch their actions. However, there are clues that would put them all, with the possible exception, and I'm going to pull my punch on this one even, of Fuller on the Calvinistic side of the ledger. If I was going to guess what side are they on, they're probably Calvinists. Now, again, when we have in our church been taught sovereignty of God, and we're not a Reformed church, but this church teaches, you know, sovereignty of God. We teach it clearly, but and we also know somewhat how it works better than most people. Most churches don't even teach this stuff anymore, you know. So I always think you guys are so ahead of it from a normal class. And so you understand what a Calvinist is, what an Arminian is, more or less, you know, could be better, but you get the idea. So what are these guys probably leaning to the Calvinist standpoint? Maybe not all exactly the same mount. So however, there are clues that would put them within the possible exception of Fuller on the Calvinistic side of the ledger. But even Fuller was Presbyterian at first. Then he became a Baptist. He went to Biola. Actually was the dean there, was a president for a short time. So an observation. This is an extra. Evangelists tend to play down their Calvinism and operate more from an appeal to man's will. If you're not an evangelist, you are an evangelist. You understand that. Thus, you tend to think Arminian. You know, what can I do to make this guy believe what I'm saying? You know, you think more like, what can I do to make him see? I know Calvinists don't think that way. They say, what can God do? But I've done some evangelizing myself, and I'm a Calvinist, but I still think that. Because when I'm out evangelizing, I'm not thinking what God's going to do. I'm thinking what I'm going to do. And then I'm wondering what he's going to do. And when I'm all done and I feel I'm an abject failure, I worry and say, well, God will take care of it. So there's my Calvinism working, not when I'm talking to him. So evangelists tend to play down their Calvinism and operate more from an appeal to man's will, thus Arminian. This may be fortuitous for those people to do that, because Calvinists, you know, tend to be quiet when the Arminians are talking. So it would be interesting to read some of Whitfield's sermons, because he was a Calvinist evangelist. And they're available. Some of these sermons are not easy to read, so I've never done that, at least looking for this. But he was a Calvinist, and he was a good evangelist, so it'd be kind of good to see how he approached the question. So the original three, we have Achengay's Congregational Puritan, you know, lines, was a Calvinist as expected. Carl Henry, a Baptist. Wheaton, probably a Calvinist, probably a little softer when I read his the comments about his uneasy book. You know, it seems like he's leaning a little bit towards the Arminian side, because we need to do this thing because then they'll respond. Well, when I do this and then they'll respond is Arminian. Okay? You know, it isn't like, well, just God's going to do his work. And no, I've got to do certain things, then they'll respond. That's Arminian. So I tend to put him a little bit on the Arminian side. And Fuller, originally a Presbyterian, now a dispensational Baptist, is also key in shaping the school to a point to keep it dispensational in his contribution. In this study, one of his apologetics can slip easily into pragmatism, like I just did. When I witness, I get into pragmatic mode, because I don't think about what God's going to do here. I got to think of what I'm supposed to do and what's the best thing to say for him so he understands. And maybe my argument, I'll be forceful. Maybe I can press this point more. So I'm thinking more like an Arminian person would talk. It's when I go home with failures that I think I'm a Calvinist. This is true. I mean, that's how you deal with that. Don't go home with guilt. So earlier we said in the classroom, look at the clock. Earlier we said in the classroom, the study of apologetics can be quite academic and theoretical and frankly hard to follow. Surely there's value in studying the discipline, but here we only mention the major categories for information's sake. I put Gil in there first, I put me in there, and I didn't want to leave anybody else out. So I just said Indian Hills as a church, I guess we'd say. Jeff will have to explain if the Edwards hold something else now, because I haven't asked them recently. But I think they're probably all agreed here. We at Indian Hills at least hold to a presuppositional approach to presenting the gospel. Now, again, we're talking about starting from dead zero scratch with a guy that's totally planted on the opposite side. Now what are you going to do? Well, then you got to pull out your presuppositional apologetics, because otherwise I'm going to start somewhere else probably. So the point is zero. That is, we do not need to have an agreement with what is to be discussed in order to have a meaningful witness, if he already knows something. If he's just fighting the will, you know, he is not willing, but he knows everything else, there's no point in going to presuppositional apologetics. He's already past that point. So when you talk about our apologetics approach, you always got to talk about the person that doesn't that knows diddly squat, got to start from scratch. What are you going to say to him? So there, and he's hostile, by the way, and he's hostile. So what are you going to start with him? So we have the presuppositional apologetics start there, and the question we start with there is, let's assume there's a God. That's how we start. Let's assume. The big word is assume. And now we're going to not do a long deal of this. I just want to get you a little flavor of how this works. In apologetics, in every other area now, on the right-hand side, I put presuppositional and fadeism on the top, and I got a question mark there. I might want to put it there. I may not want to put it there, and I don't want to argue about it, so don't argue with me about it. It doesn't matter to me, but I put it there for argument reasons because I'm not sure they're... Anyway, so on the left, you see there's an unbeliever and a believer has an overlap. Circles overlap. You got that, right? All right. Those overlapping point is where you think you've got common ground. So how would I have common ground? Well, I say, let's look at the stars. That argues for the fact that there's a creator, right? And he is obligated to say what? No? He's obligated to say yes. Isn't he? I know. Don't be the devil's advocate. Well, the believer says he's obligated to say yes because he knows there's no other logic except that God made that. It can't be. Or use anything else he made. And the believer says that. So we say, okay, now we got common ground. Now we know that God made it. Now we can go on from there, all right? But let's say he doesn't agree with you. He says, I don't think God made that. There's not a chance in a million hundred years that God made the stars out there. I just think they happen. Now what am I going to do? Well, then I go to my presuppositional apologetics. Now, you notice there's no overlap here. We share nothing in common that I can say, well, now we agree on that point. So since we don't agree on any point, what do? Then I say, let's assume a point. Assume a point. And if you want to assume a point, we're dead. Okay? Let him assume a point. Let him, and you work with him. But let's assume a point. Let's assume there is a God and he loves what he's created. Let's assume that. Where does that take us? So anyway, that's what presuppositional apologetics mean. You start with nothing but an assumption. Because that's really true, because the guy probably isn't going to really agree with me anyway on anything we can overlap. So the reason, the evidential, and others go into the left side, because they're sort of like places where we think we can have overlap. Argument is, can you have overlap? Evidentialists say yes. The presuppositional say no. So let you argue that out. I happen to be on the right-hand side here. There's no overlap, no overlapping truth. So in order to have this discussion to continue, I'm just going to have to assume something. And then if you don't like the end result of what we assume, fine. At least we've gone through the process.
Is that your right hand or our right hand?
Presuppositional people. Van Til, J. Gresham Machen, John Whitcomb, we know him. He's been here, still living. Others. From the assumption that there is an all-knowing, all-powerful God, an assumption, we ask then, what would you expect from him? I ask him, what would you expect from him? And then let him say. From there, we'll follow on with the presupposition to see where it leads. In this process, it is hoped, and then by the way, if you've never been through this exercise or through a class like this, tell the elders they should have it sometime and teach us how to do this, because it is the most effective way to get something off dead center when no one agrees to anything. All right, in this process, I hope that every person will see the validity of God who is consistent and lovingly involved with what he has done, and it's reasonable. I mean, you work through this supposition. Remember that we're talking about the foundation or the first move of our claims. Apologetics, by the way, never speak of proofs. Just talk about self-evident truths. So this approach to the first things to appeal to, these evidences of the existence of God as seen in his creation and his acts of history, are those that appeal to that are evidentialists. The evidence argues for it. The evidentialists. We would say, look at the stars, and whenever I do that, and I've done it a lot of times, just because I'm a presuppositionalist, I do not shun from using every playbook that's available to me. And if it seems appropriate at this point that he needs to look at the stars and say, yeah, there's a God that made that. If that doesn't work, I'm not going to be dead. But that's something I can use. We would say, look at the stars. They do not speak of a creator. the complexity of science, the human body, the organization of the animal world, and you go on and on and on and on, anything you can see would be evidence. So how can they be an accident? Let him answer. Who can witness the forming of the earth? Let him answer. What are the probabilities of this happening by random chance? Let him answer. And by the way, we're down the road of Josh McDowell, and evidence demands a verdict. I see his son now is also demanding more evidence or something. It's his book co-authored. That's one reason. This approach is to consider the most logical cause of what exists. Reason. Perhaps used in conjunction with evidence, we could argue that Christianity is a reasonable system that answers all the questions of life in a convincing and consistent way. That's reasonable. Ex nihilo, creation out of nothing, of an all-powerful God, is reasonable. So, the hypothesis is working for the best reality. One we use all the time is the witness apologetic. The fourth is my witness apologetic. Your testimony of saving faith can be the most powerful approach to pressing the truth. Let me tell you what happened to me. That's a form of apologetics, an apology. And it's a powerful one, especially to your friends and your family. Now, it's kind of been dulled by postmodernism. Says, I don't care what happened to you. I'm a different person. I don't care what happened to you. But it used to be that, wow, you used to be this and you're this. Wow, what happened? Well, I can tell them, all right? So that's using that system. So we sometimes call this the fideist or the faith approach to apologetics. As this goes, I know that God exists and I am saved because Jesus lives in me. And it's my experience. It's my witness. This is a witness argument. God, the Bible has been found to be true as God's faithful revelation. And you go on and on and on. Those that came to my mind, and with time I just slapped them down. So many others. Now, it's complicated, all these different kind of approaches to apologetics. Add to the complexity of the discussion are the various occasions where apologetics are at work or can be used. Think of the time when we take the various postures. Sometimes we're doing an offensive move. Sometimes we're defending. Sometimes we're just giving a witness or a testimony. Sometimes we're trying to persuade somebody. Sometimes we're trying to warn somebody. And all of these probably take different forms of apologetics. Okay, so if you limit yourself to one, a presuppositionalist, I've always got to start with ground one. It takes me half an hour to get to point two, and I could have skipped all that if he's already there. So we talk about presuppositional, or the apologetics basic is where we start when we have opposition and we have nothing else to build on. Okay? Because nothing will change that mind. Evidence won't change his mind. Reason won't change his mind. You finally have to go to something that you can agree on, and that's a presupposition. So if you limit yourself to one apologetic, you find yourself speechless at times, I think. Well, it is one thing to argue for a position in a sterile environment of a classroom or in a coffee shop. It is another venue to be useful in a personal witness, a class lecture, an evangelism training session, and so forth. While we are presuppositional in the cold approach, the cold start approach, to evangelism, there are few opportunities for such a beginning point. There's not been many points there. I mean, I've used it. But a lot of times, you know, people down the road, and you can use it if a person is well-trained because it helps them think it through. So, well, I don't know. Let's just assume there's a God, and, you know, whether you believe one or not, let's assume there is one. Let's talk about it. So we often talk about religious people. We need to be a Calvinist who is able to be comfortable to use all the tools of persuasion and make appeals to the lost to be saved at any level. The big divide, beside the kinds of apologetics we have, is the Arminian Calvinism divide. The most telling fracture is between the Arminians and the Calvinists. Calvinian, is that not a word? I mean, if we can have Arminian, can't we have Calvinian? I mean, it's sometimes hard to say a word because they need to want them to match up a little bit. So, I mean, if that's never been done before, I invented a word. Calvinian assessment of man. So we have Dave Hunt, remember him? God rest his soul. He's now with the Lord, and I believe that he is. Dave Hunt, even though he's an Arminian, Dave Hunt, the apologist, was an Arminian, avowed Arminian, wrote a strong book against Calvinism, bad book against Calvinism, turned some people against Calvinism that was wrong, but anyway, him. Spoke here a number of times, was devastated, personally devastated one evening after he had preached with a half a dozen nuns sitting in the front row of our church. He believed that the simple presentation of evidence, which he presented in his message, surely would turn the hearts, their hearts to the Lord. And I was astounded that he believed that. You know, you really thought that what you did tonight, those little guys sitting there with the white bandits are going to turn to the Lord because of your arguments? Yes. I didn't talk to him. I guilt talked to him, so I didn't get into I just heard about it later. So I really thought that. So when that did not happen, he felt devastated because surely he had failed. And it was not his approach was wrong in his mind. It was that he failed to do a good job. Devastated. That's why I say that's when I go to my Calvinism mode. So I did the best I could, Lord. Use the rest. All right, so that's what happens. You know, you just expect the Calvinism, Arminianism, there's an expectation there that is unrealistic. So understanding the Great Divide, it is surprising to me to see these Calvinists in our three, gang of three, turn to what seems to me an Arminian approach when it comes to the overcoming of the obstacles in winning America. It just seems to me like they've gone to an Arminian approach, these Calvinists have. So my little picture here, and it's not my picture, I just picked it up. So my little picture is thinking about obstacles. These guys saw Christianity moving forward with obstacles in the way. Rocks in the way, a bridge over a stream, you know, gates you got to cross, whatever. Puddles you got to jump. I just took a stream. And there are three things that are stopping the winning of America. The fundamentals were separating themselves from the main body of Christians. There's a lack of scholarship. I'm not doing this in the right order. There's a lack of scholarship. And then there is a lack of social conscience. These people are suffering and they need help and we need to do something to help them. I almost have a tear in my eye. So we got to get over this stuff because if we don't get over this stuff, we're not going to win America. Remember, whatever winning America means is. Now, at the end of my picture, you see that little round thing? It says, if you can't read it, it says Winning America. That's my logo I've been using. So we have these three things that they are objected to or were considered obstacles to win America. First one, the idea that the fundamentalists need to be more inclusive in their ideas of Christianity than the strident separatists that they were practicing. Second, they need to develop the social consciousness that deals with the growing social needs that came out of World War I and communism is coming on strong and the world's going to the devil. We've got to do something. And then we have this argument from the European continent that are so strong, we've got to defend against these guys that are coming in and corrupting our young people's minds. And they don't even believe the Bible anymore. We have to get scholars that can answer these questions because these will finally overrun us all and we'll all lose America, whatever that is. So in our metaphor, crossing over the bridge, the neo-evangelicals believe it is necessary to cross the river to win America. They have three obstacles preventing their crossing. Remember, the other side of the river is reaching, winning America. So by eliminating or downplaying, separating the Christians, the crossing over is more likely to work than standing firm in militant protests. If we become agreeable people, then this opposition to winning America will melt. So who wants to fight anyway? So let's just give up and let them have their way, and we'll join them, and we'll kumbaya together, and we'll win America. So separation or inclusivism, that's the question. Is this issue, I ask here, is this issue an apologetic one? And I say certainly is. It certainly can be, even if we can't easily classify what kind of apologetics is it. Remember, in apologetics, objective is which approach is correct where more will be won for America. That approach is the good one we want to use. And it was which option will be the most successful. Will joining be more successful or separating be more successful? The question is it better that the separate speak from the outside, you know, outside to the rest? The inclusivists argues it would be better that he speaks from inside the group rather than from the outside the group. And because one side you get the image you get preached at, and the other side you get in, you do, you know, these kumbaya things, and which is better. So they argue about this, and so they cross the bridge, To cross the bridge remains, or to cross the bridge, or to remain separate. And that's what they want to do. And they're choosing not to stay separate. They want to join together because that'll help them reach America. So for Henry and Achingay, the harsh rhetoric coming from the fundamentalists, and including Carl McIntyre and others, separates the modernists from the fundamentalists. So, you know, if Carl McIntyre has his way, the modernists will be over there and the fundamentalists will be over here. So how can the modernists ever be exposed to the truth if they're over? If the conservatives are over here? They'll be shut out of this conversation. Kind of logical. So the neo-evangelicals do not want to adopt this separateness policy. They want intimacy, sharing what we have in common, which is we all want to win America. Remember, we don't know what that is exactly, but we want to do it. With the neo-evangelicals, to win the modernists over, now they're not going to get in this group and cave into them. They're going to be in the group and dominate them. They're going to take them by their noses and they're going to lead them down the right road, they think. So the neos to win the modernists over to preserve Christian nation. This is an apologetic choice. Say, get with them and explain to them what we really believe. They'll buy into our, and we save America by hanging together. It's an apologetic approach. Now, the Presbyterians have a difficult time drawing lines. In other words, the separation lines. It's easy for them to do kumbaya. The Presbyterians have a difficult time drawing hard lines between important distinctions. Thus, they were more inclusive. They continued to baptize infants and thus absorbed unsaved members into the fellowship. So it was kind of an undefined fellowship already. Adding a few more modernists wasn't so strange to them. They continue to baptize infants, thus absorbed unsaved members in the fellowship, making it hard for the fundamentalists, who generally were divisionals, Baptists, separationals. So we have within the group kind of this tug of war. So the dispensation generally, our separatists, were concerned with the corruption that follows close unbeliever associations. Now underneath of this is the covenant philosophy. We haven't talked about that yet, but it's got to be there. You know? All right, maybe we'll get to it yet. They believe that what they needed is a witness from the outside, not dispensationalists believe that we needed a witness from the outside, not from within, inside the modernist churches. And by the way, the Anabaptists gained this ground, 200 years ago. So they were about ready to give it up again. Although, and these three, they're together on this. They're not like, arguing. It's guys like Martin McIntyre arguing. So the answer from the neo-evangelicals was inclusiveness on pragmatic grounds. It'll just work better. Concerning apologetics, it was, I guess you call fadism. It's their testimony of how this will work best. Comes closest to the plan of inclusiveness. That should appeal to the modernists. That is, if I accept them, not reject them, that'll be a good thing, in a matter of faith. So in our river crossing metaphor, the generous evangelicals will endeavor to meet the modernists halfway. Supposing that each will accept the other in the middle together on the bridge, with the commonality, we will join together and win America. Noting, as this works out, there surely is a separation, but the separation is not between the modernists and the evangelicals, it is between the neo-evangelicals and the evangelicals. So the neo-evangelicals and the modernists join together and the fundamentalists are off by themselves. So the division happens, but it happens in a different place. By joining the modernists and neo-evangelicals, abandoned the successful fundamentalists. By the way, they have forgotten how successful the fundamentalists have been in the last 30 years because they didn't follow a certain prescribed thought pattern. Like they weren't the intellectuals, they weren't joined together, and they were concerned about social concerns because that was what's going to change it. They didn't look at the successes that the fundamentalists had enjoyed. And by the way, the modernists never took one step toward the fundamentalists. All the compromise was on the neo-evangelical side. And that's something you always forget. So we're going to skip the second one here, the conscience part. To develop conscience, just because of time, I'm going to skip this. I'm going to go to the third one here, the scholarship issue. And the doors are locked. You cannot leave till I'm done. So we developed a scholarship that contributes to the body of Christian thought at a level that even those rejecting fundamentalism will have to acknowledge. Now we look at the third obstacle the neo-evangelicals saw for them to win America. The lack of scholarship, the apologetic in play here, is clearly the appeal to reason. So Christianity is something. Christianity, if it is something, is a reasonable faith. Amen? As it goes, it has internal consistent logic supported by internal and external evidence, and any person exposed to this truth will see it as reasonable and will be enlisted to winning America. That should do it. Our fundamentalists have built schools and ministry that have not answered the questions raised by the scholars in Europe. What we know about them, one is Schleiermacher and one is Wellhausen. Those guys got to be answered. What is needed is some original, fine-tuned, up-to-date argument about the truth of God that will discredit them. Akige says, there are serious questions challenging evangelicals today, and they're coming from rationalism, from secularism, from evolutionary ideas. We got to stop this. I think his concerns are good, right on target. The evangelicals will have to write against these destructors of Christianity, or America is lost. See, there we go again. We have to win America. We can't have these deviant ideas out there in our schools, and no one's writing against them. Those books are not on the library. They take an opposite view. The intelligent and bright scholars of modernist America will not be impressed by simply staying with the literal reading of the Bible subjects, you know, like the dispensationalists seem to do. The Europeans have done so much more with the Bible, perhaps negatively, than the fundamentalists have. We have few, if any, who can compete with the scholarship of the modernist school. The experience of men at Harvard revealed another world of learning, challenges, and learning. Whoop, learning twice. All right. They have just discovered there's another world out there they have not been part of. And that since they're really bright guys, they say, I want to be part of that. So when we have trained our scholars in the way the Europeans have our scholars... So when we have trained our scholars in the way the Europeans have our scholars, our scholars will be able to hold the ground of Scripture and convince the modernists that they have misunderstood the Bible. So there's a hope here that modernists can be turned from their deviancy. And we sit here and say, not a chance, you know, but they don't think that way. They've been in our church, have they? When this becomes apparent to them, they will respect our work. And when our scholars, the evangelical scholars, will rise up, they'll write these works, they'll respect our work. And even they, if they do not embrace the truth, they will still honor our scholarship because the value in itself is important. So informing the evangelicals, there is no doubt that these fundamentalists, Henry and Ockenge, even Fuller, felt overwhelmed by the modernist arguments and believe that in the training of a new cadre of new scholars, they would be able to mount an opposition to the modernist drift. Now, Fuller's son Daniel will study under Karl Barth rather than snuff out the candle of Barth. Daniel Fuller gets burned instead. We'll see that later. So remember that the students at Harvard noticed that of the great scholarly works produced by the evangelicals, virtually none were found on the shelves of the modernist school library. That needed to be changed. It was their resolve, these Harvard graduates, to fill those shelves with scholarly evangelical works. For this purpose, the Fuller faculty will be given light teaching load so that they can write and publish at least two or three times every two or three years, fill these vacuums in these libraries. Question, how can these evangelicals' position be considered when their books were not worthy of consideration? So these guys, Archangel, say, you know, we have the greatest position there is. It's from the Word. It's impeccable. It's from God. And those books are not on their shelves. Let's have our scholars put our books from the Bible on their shelves. The motivation isn't bad. But the price to get it done killed them. So remember last week, we talked about a simple concept of coloring inside the lines. The Bible student is mandated to work inside the lines. His scholarship to be of any value must be found inside the lines. If outside, then perhaps background studies. But when you do it, you explicitly understand what you're doing. I might study a geography book to get the background of the land, but I understand it's a geography book and not the Bible. However, what is being asked of these scholars is to study outside these lines. It is here, they say, where the great value of the scholarship is realized, outside the lines. It is equal, even greater than the value of the literal text, they say. Outside is where scholarship makes its useful, real useful contribution. Oh, I didn't put him up. And that's what you get when you are outside lines. I lose it. There it goes, a little slow. So that's the creature you get when you color outside their lines. It's grotesque. On the surface, this line is so clear that no real danger lurks because the line is set, is stationary. Oh, but the danger is in the subtle craft of a scholar who can move the line, thicken the line, fuzzy up the line so that what is outside is moved to the inside. In time, by small increments, he can craft an entirely new image. A false Christianity is subject to the redefinition by the wizards of deception. So even though you say I'm staying within my line, you make sure that someone had moved it. And that's what happens with the social stuff. They get the lines moved. And all of a sudden we find that we're inside the line and we're not doing what the inside the line said. But remember, whoa, 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 somebody moved the line on us. Let's move the back line where it should be. Then all of a sudden, all right, that's next week. Has to do a little bit with this. Well, we'll have an opportunity next week to see this line move in the mysterious moving of the line that now includes contributions on the evangelical scholars of ethics, morality, and social justice issues. They are now moved to inside the line. Here we got 20% of the kids are in poverty. There's probably 100 of these. 21% of the kids are in poverty. Their share of the national debt apiece is $60,000. Now, there's something wrong with that picture. How'd we get here? All right, that's what we're going to talk about. Well, supposing, supposed,